the thing working now? So hopefully I don't, I'm used to projecting, not using a microphone, so I hope I won't be yelling too loud. I was saying my abstract was maybe appropriately mocked for being a little vague and general, unclear what I was speaking about. That was in part due to my not quite having a sense of who the audience is and how much algebraic geometry they're used to thinking about as opposed to related fields. So let me start by setting the stage and giving some general ideas. So throughout the talk, a variety embedded into a smooth, complex projective variety X. And the guiding problem, which is too vague to solve in general, but will motivate everything in the talk, is just to relate the geometric properties of Y to the equations which cut out Y in X. So, in particular, lots of people in algebraic geometry don't think about the equations that define their varieties. So this is a proper subset of all algebraic geometry. And there are two sides to this. Okay. Two sides, one, the geometry of Y, or geometric properties, maybe I should say, bound the so the geometry bounds the algebra for the complexity of the equations. The idea is to use geometric conditions insight to get control over the equations which define your variety, cut it out. And then the other side is the algebraic invariance arising from the equations encode the geometry. Right, this is tautological in some sense. But what I imagine is sort of subtle invariance, maybe the syzygies, the higher Betti numbers coming from the equations, encode subtle geometric information about your variety. So you can try and go in the other direction. So geometry telling you things about algebra, or algebra telling you things about geometry. In this talk, I'm going to focus almost exclusively on the first. I think that's the one area in algebraic geometry where we've had the most success. There are some conjectures and results in this area, maybe Green's conjecture, the most famous, going from algebra back to geometry. But in some sense, this direction is underdeveloped in my perspective, from my point of view. So as I said, I'm going to concentrate on the first one, and let me give you some examples which are more explicit. This is a little too soft to hold on to. So uniform bounds. So my first few examples will make X the ambient variety, just projective space. And let me start with the definition, which will somehow be a notion of complexity. If X is projective space, then we say the coherent sheaf F is M regular. M is an integer if some appropriate higher cohomology vanishes. So this is a so I want to think of M as measuring the complexity of my sheaf. Most of the time F is going to turn out to be the structure sheaf of some subvariety, particularly of Y. This definition was introduced by Mumford. In fact, he described it as an apparently silly definition. But Mumford introduced this notion of complexity to construct the Hilbert scheme. Or I should say, maybe more precisely, Grothendieck had constructed before, and he wanted to give a slightly different construction and use it to analyze properties. So in particular, if I have a sheaf that's, or if I think of F as being the structure sheaf and it's M regular, then I know the equations that define the ideal associated to that subvariety are generated degree most M. In fact, better than that, it has control over higher syzygies also, which turn out, in fact, having control over the first syzygies is important in constructing the Hilbert scheme. And so how does this show up, or where's the uniform bound? Mumford gave a bound coming through this, and there's been subsequent work, and the optimal bound in this direction was discovered by Gutzmann. It says the following: for a fixed Hilbert polynomial, let's call it Q. So in this, if I want to think geometric, this is the Euler characteristic of twists of the structure sheaf. There exists unique integers, okay, positive integers, a1 greater than a2 down to am, such you can write your polynomial in one variable as a sum of binomial coefficients in a, well, at first experience, slightly strange way. But in fact, the sum of M binomial coefficients. Okay, so you can write every Hilbert polynomial in this way, and when you write it out like this, the upshot is for any variety that has this as its Hilbert polynomial, the ideal sheaf is M regular. So in particular, this is important if you want to construct the Hilbert scheme, is it gives you a uniform bound on the generators of the ideals with a given Hilbert polynomial. Right? So the idea is, in fact, the basic idea is pretty simple. You want to construct the Hilbert scheme, so you fix a Hilbert polynomial, and you say, what are all the subschemes that have this? This tells you they're all generated in some fixed degree, so I can take the vector space that we consider the ideal associated, just look at the graded piece in degree M, and that's a vector space of some dimension. I can look at the appropriate Grassmannian, and so then you just have to look at the condition, what does it take for those vector spaces to actually correspond to an ideal, and that defines a subvariety of the appropriate Grassmannian, and you show the existence of a scheme parametrizing all subschemes of projective space with a fixed Hilbert polynomial. So it's a nice result, and this is a, as I say, this is the optimal bound, and I think a situation where So I think of, in this case, the Hilbert polynomial as being geometric input, and we're getting control over the complexity. So a nice example. I want to look at a second set of way geometry gives us control over complexity, so bounds from equations. So unlike this situation where the input was knowing just the Hilbert polynomial, in many geometric situations you have some control over what cuts out. You have some influence over equations which cut out your variety, and you want to get control over the complexity. So let me be more precise about that. The ideal sheaf of some subvariety Y is Skene theoretically cut out by sections of some line bundles, Li's, if the sections vanish on your variety and the induced map from the direct sum of the duals to your ideal sheaf is surjective. Right. So the scheme theoretically is important. This isn't saying I have minimal generators for the ideal defining this subvariety. You're just saying I know some equations that vanish on there, and sort of eventually they're good enough. So there's a lot of geometric situations where you can get enough equations to cut out your variety in this sense, and you want to have control over the complexity. So particularly I want to control the regularity given this as input. There's a couple of results that were known in this direction. First theorem goes back to David Beyer and Mumford. I think it was known around 84. It wasn't published until much later, so this is somewhat of a guess as to the right time period. It says that Y is in projective space again, is cut out in the sense defined above by hypersurfaces of degree at most D. Then the ideal sheaf is M regular for some M less than 2D, the N factorial. Okay, so we get this, I think, horrific bound in some sense. I know the two things, the dimension of my ambient space and a bound on the degree of the sections that cut out my variety, then I can bound the regularity. That's basically all this is saying. So it's 2d to the n factorial. This grows painfully fast. So, okay, we have a, there exists some bound, but is it really this horrific? And somewhat surprisingly or depressingly, the answer is yes. You can't do much better. A theorem or example due to Mayer and Meyer, D2, which says there exists Y in projective space cut out by hypersurfaces degree at most. Most E, such that the ideal sheaf is M regular only if M is greater than or equal to D minus 2 to the 2. I get this power of exponents. 2 raised to the exponent N over 10. So, okay, there's a bit of a gap between those things, but this says that, I mean, some rough, we can't do a lot better, right? There are some horrifically complex varieties out there. So it's kind of depressing and makes you think we should just end the story here. But fortunately, that's not the case. So I should say, these examples predate, they weren't thinking or interested in questions specifically about algebraic geometry. They were interested in word problems in semigroup complexity, and the examples they produce, the family of examples, are very combinatorial in structure, and that allows you to analyze what's going on and get these bounds. We really have a lack of techniques for producing poorly behaved examples. So in fact, part of what went into this is some people knew these complexity bounds and didn't use any Grobner basis theory to analyze things in algebraic geometry, because how could it ever work when you have these sort of complexity bounds? We should never expect the Grobner basis algorithms to terminate. Dave Beyer and Mike Stillman were not so aware of those details and wrote Macaulay and saw that on geometric examples it ran beautifully well. They never saw anything close to complexity this bad. And so why is that? What's the difference? And so there's what has emerged is a clear dichotomy. For nice varieties, the complexity grows linearly. Okay. And we don't have a full grasp on what precisely nice should be, but let me give some examples of things that are certainly nice, and we don't see complexity anything like that. So I think there was originally some examples in curves that started to illustrate this difference, but I'd like to look at a theorem that came a little later. I think I find more convincing that there's this difference. This is a result due to Bertram, Hein, and Lesersfeld, 91, says the following: let y in x be smooth with codimension C. So certainly smooth subvarieties should be considered nice, if anything is going to be considered nice. And then we need some equations to cut out a variety if Y is cut out by sections. So we fix one line bundle, but you're allowed to take different tensor powers of it. So the sections aren't necessarily the same line bundle, where the line bundle is globally generated. We may as well order our indices so that they're weakly decreasing. And for technical reasons, I can throw in another line bundle, A is big enough. Then we can look at the higher cohomology of our ideal sheaf. I'll slide it up as soon as I get it written. So we get a vanishing of a whole bunch of cohomology. In some sense, if we're bigger than the first few, so what is this saying? It takes a little touch. We're taking a smooth subvariety. Again, it's cut out by some equations where we're given the degrees in some sense. We know the power of the line bundle. So we think of the DIs as degree information. We order the degrees at, just for convenience more than anything else. Okay, A is some, for people in the field, usually you can throw in things like that. So I get the ideal sheet. That's what I'm trying to measure the complexity of. I'm tensoring with the canonical bundle on X. On the line bundle, I take some power and A comes along for the ride, and as long as the power of L is greater than the sum of the first codimension many, remember C is the codimension, then I get this vanishing uniformly. Okay. So that's a nice vanishing result. Right. And what consequence does it have in terms of complexity? It says in particular, we can, through a little bit of effort, you can see that IY is, so the ideal sheaf is D1 plus BC minus C plus 1 regular. So we, in particular, we get this linear bound. You just fix these numbers. There's no exponentials, nothing horrific going on. So this vanishing theorem maybe look slightly technical, but the point is we get a linear bound, and we really see this dichotomy that for, in this case, smooth varieties, we don't get anything like the horrific examples. Things are much, much simpler. And this is part of the reason why the varieties geometers tend to study are, well, not necessarily smooth, tend to be in the nice end of the spectrum, and we didn't see or don't see this terrible growth in complexity. So this is, I think, a very nice result, and it certainly has motivated, well, as you'll see, it's motivated some of my work, but also before that led to results by Chardin and Ulrich, and more recently by Tefernik and Ein, generalize this. This result by allowing both Y and X to have mild singularities. So they allow different sorts of singularities. Chardin and Ulrich are sort of interested in complete intersection type things, and the Fernex and Ein in the more recent preprint are interested in log canonical type singularities. One has to change the statement slightly to get their result. But my point is you can extend these things. This is not particular. I mean, smooth is, I think, certainly should be included in nice varieties, but there's certainly evidence that nice includes more than just smooth things. And in fact, where the borderline is, I don't think we have a good delineation of at this point. As I say, part of the problem is the bad examples are really the one family in minor variations coming from the beginning, and we don't know how to produce bad examples in general. Yep. They in fact prove it for X being smooth, so they don't need PN in there. I'm emphasizing that difference because I'm going to want to change right now, not PN. That's where I want to go. Alternative ambient spaces. So, as suggested, I've emphasized PN there, and it's slightly unfair, but somehow the point is there's only one line bundle of which all your sections are coming from up to powers. And that's the thing I want to change more than just projective space. So, I'm on projective space, and I'm allowing twists. it feels like one line bundle. And so the many varieties, many interesting y are defined by or with an embedding into an X where the rank of Picard group of X is strictly greater than 1. So they aren't coming from a single line bundle or even powers of a single line bundle. There's something more going on. So you may not believe that statement. Let me give you some examples of what I think at least are interesting varieties with this property. So a presentation for the Cox ring of a Mori dream space is essentially an embedding into a smooth torque, into a torque variety. So the Cox ring is somehow the total coordinate ring of your variety. You consider all the Picard, all the generators in Picard, all the line bundles. You choose a set of generators and you choose bases, and you make a ring out of that. Right? So it depends a little on the choice of sections, but up to isomorphism it doesn't. And Mori dream spaces are almost by definition those spaces where this is going to be a finitely generated ring. And so there's interest in writing down explicit presentations for such spaces, in part because there's some arithmetic interpretations. You can count points via universal torsors. But so the algebra question of giving a presentation for this ring can be thought of geometrically, as I say, it's essentially the same as embedding your variety into a torque variety and understanding the equations which cut it out in that variety. This variety is going to have, the embedding is going to involve a lot more than one line bundle. Second family of examples, I'll say a variety is very affine. If it can be embedded into its intrinsic torus. So, some varieties have this property. I believe the definition's due to Tevelev. And for varieties that have this property, right, there's sub-varieties of a torus you might want to compactify. So a tropical compactification. Of Y is, or comes from, an embedding in a toric variety. Again, essentially never projective space. So this is, again, a family of examples. The applications maybe that are most, ones I like particularly in this direction is M0N bar and the moduli space of Del Pezzo surfaces, which Hacking, Tevelev, and Keel describe as a tropical compactification. So these are interesting varieties that one can try and study. And a third family of examples, varieties arising from algebraic statistics are often lie in products of projective spaces. Frequently, the dimension of the total space is, the dimension of the factors is much, much smaller than the number of factors. So it can be often a product of P1s where there's a lot of P1s, not just sort of two or three, but many more. And so these are at least three sources of examples where somehow the natural embedding isn't into projective space and isn't given by sections of a single line bundle. And I'm interested in all three of these situations and would like tools that apply. So what is the, what I might refer to as the multigraded setting? How can we treat all of these situations and try and develop tools like we had before? So to do that, I want to fix globally generated line bundles. Let's choose R of them. So first, just to save some chalk, let me introduce some multi-index notation. So for an integer vector, I'll simply write L to the vector U as the first vector, taking the L1 to the U1 tensor component, tensor U2. So I think it's the same sort of thing we do with polynomials and lots of variables. And I'm going to make one assumption about this collection. Assume that there exists some vector. In fact, I want it to have positive entries. Such that this vector is ample. I need to remember I'm actually on a projective variety. I need to have some positivity, some ampleness lurking around. So none of the individual line bundles have to be ample, but I have to be able to get something ample from them. So the challenge, or the, it's sort of silly, but worth stating, basic challenge in this setting is that convex cones in R to the R are much more interesting when R is large. Right. Somehow not obvious, I mean, it's certainly a tautological statement, but it's the difference between doing what was done before, where you had one line bundle. They exploit all the time that they can totally order things and choose the biggest. And that things are generated. I mean, if you have a collection, there's a minimal generator. This gets done all the time. And all of those things fail as soon as R is bigger than 1. And so this simple observation is the root of the challenge in trying to generalize these things for almost all things in this direction. So one other comment. It may seem very strange. It may seem that I've abandoned completely the embedding into projective space, and David Cox has a nice theorem that says that really I haven't. This is fits into the framework where we're projective space very nicely. And so the theorem says that maps from some subvariety or variety Y to a smooth toric variety. X correspond to to sections of some family of line bundles. I guess there's the reason why, such that of satisfying explicit compatibility. Non-degeneracy conditions. Right, so I think many people in the room know to describe a map into projective space, you need to choose a line bundle, sections which don't vanish anywhere. Right? And that extends. That's what this result is saying. If you want to put a map into a projective variety, you need to choose not one line bundle, but a collection of line bundles and sections on all of them, again, satisfying some compatibility and non-degeneracy conditions that are explicitly described. The explicit conditions depend on some of the combinatorics of your toric variety, so I won't spell them out. So this framework where we have a collection of line bundles really does sort of fit into these examples where we're embedding into toric varieties. So I haven't sort of left that natural world. So what can we say, what sort of analogs do we get to the earlier results? Let's return to the uniform bound. All right. Maybe ask, how am I going to measure complexity in this situation? Well, I'm going to mimic what Mumford did. So for some line bundle A on X, we say that our coherent sheaf F is A regular. If, again, the higher cohomology vanishes, this time I tensor with A and tensor with L to the minus U for all I greater than 0 and all vectors whose sum of components is equal to I. So in the case that R is equal to 1, we're getting exactly the definition before, except I've made the identification of the integers with the Picard group on projective space. So instead of having M, I would say O of M in this setting. So good question. So why is this a natural? Why is this the right thing? I think this is, as Mumford said, the apparently silly part. It's really a homological condition. It allows you to do some. It plays well in short and long exact sequences, and so it allows you to show that if you're A regular and I tensor with something that's NEF, I will still be regular in that setting. So it's there's a whole cone worth of things for which I have regularity, and this condition is, as I say, plays nice in long exact sequences, sort of a homological fudge factor. And it's amusing to note that. It shows up in the definition, but it didn't show up in the Bertrand-Ein-Lazarsfeld result. They didn't have any sort of fudge factor like this showing up. And so you see that although this is the definition for complexity and it plays well, the natural vanishing theorems often don't have this sort of condition showing up in them. And so you sort of get more vanishing and than is needed explicitly for regularity. So there is some tension or difference there. So what's the analog of Gutzmann's result? This is something I worked out with Diane McLaughlin a few years ago. I think it appeared in 2005. It says if a fixed Hilbert function, Hilbert polynomial, now my Hilbert polynomial is not going to be a polynomial in one variable, but in R variables, because I can tensor with any of my line bundles, L, I. So this is T, I guess, the way of Bennett. All right, so something that doesn't seem to be as well known as I think it should be, it goes back to at least Snapper, so much older result, is even if you have more than one line bundle, you still get a polynomial. This thing is, and it's not a polynomial in one variable, but in many variables. Although the fact that it's a polynomial does use the smoothness of x, otherwise you only get a quasi-polynomial, whatever that is. So what does the result say? If we fix this, then there exists an explicit decomposition of the polynomial into M some and the ideal sheaf associated is uniformly regular. Okay. So I didn't tell you what the some ends are, so it's a weak statement of a theorem, even if it is a correct statement. The idea is this specializes in the case R equals 1 to give us Gutzmann's result, and what replaces the binomial coefficient. I should think of the binomial coefficients as the Hilbert polynomial or even Hilbert function of a polynomial ring. And the decomposition we got there was the Hilbert functions of sub-polynomial rings. We're getting rid of variables, and the sum ends that show up here are exactly going to be the Hilbert polynomials of sub-polynomial rings in the toric setting. So there is a way to do this more generally. And so one in particular can define multigraded Hilbert schemes. And it seems basically a wide open problem to understand the geometry of such things. Multigraded Hilbert schemes. So you may say, well, just a second, the usual Hilbert scheme, we don't understand the geometry particularly well. Why generalize? Well, one reason I think we don't understand is those examples grow very quickly. In some sense, there's a sparsity of small examples. And when you allow the multigraded setting, you certainly get many more small examples. Maybe there are going to be more nice examples. Evidence is, I would say, lacking in either direction. One thing that's different here, the one positive result about the usual Hilbert scheme of projective space, it's connected. And there are examples known of relatively large multigrade things that are not connected. So when are they connected, and trying to understand connectivity is certainly, I think, an interesting question. But I don't have any deep insights. So it's the analog of the second part that has been more recently of interest to me. So multigraded bounds from equations. So this theorem is joint work with Victor, who's currently a postdoc at Queen's. And it's the multigraded analog of the Bertrand-Ein-Lazarsfeld result. So if y in x is smooth with codimension c, or let, and then if y is cut out by sections of our various family of line bundles, assume A is nothing big, then we get a similar vanishing result. Where I need a condition on this exponent, and the condition I think is similar, although it looks a little strange the first time you see it. So I have to tensor with some negative powers of C of these line bundles, and I want that to be globally generated. Where the indices run over all subsets of C of our line bundles. Okay. So, right, as I said before, when R is not equal to 1, we can't use inequalities. And so this is some sort of forces this to be positive enough, and what we're saying is sort of sufficiently far into the interior of the Neff cone. I'll slide it up for people for that. So sort of all ways of subtracting one of each of, you know, C guys, right? In particular, why do I have to consider all subsets? Well, I don't know how to totally order them. So I have to consider all subsets and subtract and still have some positivity. So that's the analog of, well, they could totally order their degrees and get something nice. So in particular, this gives us, again, a linear bound on the multigrade at regularity. Linear bound. So this dichotomy that we saw when there was only one line bundle extends to when you have a finer degrees or more gradings. You still don't encounter the issues that arise in the bad examples. So that, I think, is somewhat novel. In particular, the bad example has a lot of additional homogeneity. So you might have thought the additional homogeneity always caused problems like that. This says that's not the case. And so what is the idea of the proof? So in fact, a few years after the original publication, Bertram wrote a preprint, which is on the archive and doesn't seem to have appeared anywhere else, suggesting a different way or outlining a different proof of the original theorem. And right, the basic idea is, well, it wasn't available to them at the time they were doing the original proof, but now seems to be a standard tool, and that's to use multiplier ideals. So in particular, replace your ideal sheaf by a well-chosen. Multiplier ideal. Okay, this is the basic ingredient. And in particular, with that flexibility, you don't have to use or exploit the total orderings as they did in the original proof. So let me be more explicit. In the time available, I certainly can't give you all the details, but let me at least sketch basic ideas. First thing to do is to pull back to the blow-up. Right. This turns your ideal sheaf into a line bundle, and then you can use line bundle techniques. Okay. That's the first thing to do. The second step is to use Bertini's theorem. So this is the key step that uses the smoothness on Y, in particular smoothness connected to the sections, to construct a divisor for which the zeros of the associated multiplier ideal are disjoint with the exceptional divisor. Okay. That's slightly vague, and there's certainly lots of ways to do that. And the point is, once you have this multiplier ideal, then you can use some well-known vanishing theorems for multiplier ideals. So you can use so-called Nadel vanishing to prove an analog of the theorem. For this associated multiplier ideal, and then the tension or the challenge is to connect this back to your original guy, so you have to use some short exact sequences to relate the multiplier ideal and the ideal sheaf. So the idea to use multiplier ideals in this, again, is due to Bertram, and is also done by the Fernex and Ein, who I mentioned before. And there's tension in steps 2 and 4, right? It's easy to construct multiplier ideals than this, but if you do it, if you're sort of not careful about how you do it, then you can't relate it back. So the tension is between 2 and 4. And you have to sort of play that off in a somewhat delicate fashion, in fact, a slightly technical fashion, it seems, thus far, to connect the two and get the vanishing you want. So it's a completely different approach than the original proof of Bertrand Ein and Lazarsfeld, and still has some different ideas than the original Bertram in how you choose the multiplier ideal to get the things to work out. Maybe I'll make one comment to end, is how good is this bound? Right? Is this, you know, we proved this, but is this far from the best possible bound, close? Where are we in the spectrum? And so I should say that Bertrand and Lazarsfeld show that their bound is optimal, and they actually characterize the varieties for which it's optimal as complete intersections. So they give a very strong statement saying that you can't hope for better vanishing in their situation because the complete intersections have non-vanishing if you try and push it in any direction. So it's perfect in that sense. In the multigraded setting, right, it's maybe we can't hope for as much since our hypotheses we use little of the geometry. Of X, it's not surprising. There's a verb in there. It's not surprising that our bound, our multigraded bound, is not sharp in general. Right. In particular, because of the canonical showing up there, if the canonical happens to be ample or something, it's sort of easier to have this condition be true. where if it, so depending on sort of the classification, it's a different result. Nevertheless, we construct smooth Fano torque varieties. X with card rank 2 such that, well, I should say in all dimensions, such that the bound is optimal. Okay, so you can't improve this result without having a different flavor of hypothesis, something that takes into account the geometry of X in a more significant way. And certainly if you know more about X, you should expect or hope for stronger results, but to have one that sort of ignores the geometry of X, you can't hope for a better result. So I think I'll stop here.